Welcome back, everybody, to the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Hemming, and for today's show, we have the author, a political blogger and economics and politics teacher from West London, Paul Goldsmith, who has written a new book, How to Lose a Referendum, the definitive story of why the UK voted for Brexit. So I had quite an intriguing conversation with Paul where he takes us right back to the formation of what has now become the European Union, and he looks at some of the missed opportunities, or otherwise, I guess you could argue, for Britain to get involved. And he leads really with the idea that the British public never had the vision of the European Union sold to them from the outset. And so when the Leave vote came around, it really shouldn't have been a surprise to anyone at all. It was a really intriguing chat, and I hope you do enjoy it. There's so much in the book that we were unable to cover, that much of it in the half an hour that we spent. But so I do recommend you look for a copy of that. Paul would obviously be really, really, really grateful. And let us know what you think of the show in general, of this interview would be great. You can follow us, obviously, on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter. And as always, thank you ever so much for tuning in to listen. And now here's Paul. Welcome back, everybody. So for those of you wondering how we ever wound up where we are today, then hopefully our next guest is going to be able to shine some light on matters. Paul Goldsmith is a political blogger and economics and politics teacher from West London, and he's also the co-author of How to Lose a Referendum, the definitive story of why the UK voted for Brexit, which he penned with Sky News senior political correspondent Jason Farrell. Paul, welcome to the show. And my first question, there's been lots of books about Brexit, so what makes yours different?
I think what makes this difference, and thank you very much for having me on the show, Tim, is our use of history to look at the reasons behind the Leave vote. The most important thing to understand is that we feel, and the headline for our book is that history pointed a gun at David Cameron's head and he chose to pull the trigger. Now, how did history point a gun at his head? It's to do with the fact that we were absent at the creation of the European community, which meant that we weren't able to shape it in our interests, the contortions, political and economic, that we went through in order to join. And then once we started to integrate, the way that our political masters never really sold the benefits to us of it. And so when it came to 2016 and the Remain campaign got together, it was really too late. So what's different about our book is that we go right back to 1945 and we look at the opportunities we had to enter. We also look at the referendum in 75 and when we joined in 73, plus the sort of gradual drib-drab of sovereignty away from us that started in 1986 with Mrs. Thatcher, ironically, and look at how effectively there was this ultimately a constellation of unique circumstances that meant that we feel in the end there would have been a Leave vote whenever the referendum was held.
Okay, so in trying to get our heads around this, let's take it back to the beginning and see when, you argue in the book that Britain missed some opportunities to influence how the European community was initially created. So if we take it back to day dot, what was that first opportunity and what's the situation there?
The European unity movement was actually sort of led by two or three different people. Firstly, Winston Churchill called for Europe to unite, and that was after the Second World War. He'd actually been removed as Prime Minister, and Clement Attlee's Labour Party were in, and they were trying to build a new Jerusalem of NHS and welfare state and things like that. But Winston Churchill then was working with the Europeans, and he was suggesting other countries unite. He wasn't, by the way, necessarily suggesting Britain worked with them. But there we go. The second were the Americans, particularly led by Dean Acheson, who was the Secretary of State. And what the Americans were concerned about was the gradual advance of the USSR. In 1948, they'd gone to Prague and other areas like that. And they wanted Europe to form a third force, in a way, in between the US and the USSR. But in particular, if Europe were able to rebuild properly, then there would be less likely of the Soviet Union creeping west. In order for that to happen, the Germans needed to be able to rebuild themselves in a way that kept security for the French. The thing to understand is that in the 1940s, if you were French, you'd been invaded by Germany every generation. And so a lot of thinking was done in how to do this. And the main bit of thinking was by a man called Jean Monnet, and he was a civil servant. He was on a walking holiday in the Alps. And as we know, some great ideas happen on walking holidays. Recently in politics, Theresa May had one. Anyway, he was in a walking holiday on the Alps, and he suddenly realized that the most important industries were coal for energy and steel as well, for building. Now, the Germans could build buildings or they could build arms. And he realized if you pull them together under a supranational authority, so that's a higher authority that can make decisions on production, if you pull them together and work together, the Germans would be able to rebuild whilst also guaranteeing French security. And he took this idea to the French leadership, and eventually he found Robert Schuman, who was the French foreign minister. And Robert Schuman and Monnet worked on something that became known as the Schuman Declaration. 9th of May 1950, he called a press conference. And in that press conference, he said something very interesting, which was that the European coal and steel community, as they called it, would make war between France and Germany materially impossible. And if you think about what's happened in the next 75 years, you can see that that was quite prescient. So Britain were invited to join those negotiations, but they were livid that they weren't involved in the creation of the idea. But also, they were trying to square the circles of Commonwealth trade and U.S. Special relationship, as well as with Europe. And they didn't want any interference in trying to build full employment and socialism and things like that. So Clement Attlee, his Chancellor Stafford Cripps, and his Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin were very skeptical about it. Eventually, Schuman and Monnet lost patience, and on June the 1st, they gave us a one-day ultimatum. Either join the negotiations or we'll continue without you. Attlee was away, Cripps was away, Ernest Bevin was in hospital. And so Herbert Morrison, Peter Mandelson's grandfather, was tracked down at the Ivy restaurant in the West End by a Treasury worker called civil servant called Edwin Plowden, who asked him what was the cabinet's decision. And Herbert Morrison famously said, "It's just no good. The Durham miners will never wear it." And so we ended up not being there at the creation of the European coal and steel community. And that's the start. But we missed that boat, but we were just about to miss the tanker.
I understand. So it really was, and you make your pains points out in your book, it really was a political union decision in a way. It wasn't about economics, it was about politics, and it was to try and keep some kind of harmony on the continent.
It was absolutely vital, and one of my favorite pictures that I found throughout this time is of Helmut Kohl, who was the German Chancellor who died recently, sadly, and François Mitterrand, the French president, holding hands at a ceremony to commemorate the Battle of Verdun in the First World War. And Maggie Thatcher thought, "Ugh, two old men holding hands," she said, allegedly. But actually, it's important because that was 40 years after the war had ended, and here France and Germany were still at peace. But going back to your question about politics and economics, when the European coal and steel community worked, there was then a series of meetings convened in Brussels in 1955 in order to explore whether they could just turn it into a full European community, a common market, free trade between each other, a customs union that therefore has an external tariff on other countries' trade. And they invited our foreign secretary, Harold Macmillan at the time, to come to a meeting of foreign secretaries to negotiate. And our prime minister at the time, Anthony Eden, refused to send Macmillan. In fact, we only sent a representative, and his name is Russell Bretherton. Hardly anyone's ever heard of him. But this poor chap was sent to a meeting of foreign secretaries with strict instructions not to agree to anything. And as he arrived at the meeting, now he was a very professional civil servant, he was an economist as well, and that's why he was sent there. He was an expert on trade. Very quickly after he arrived, although his face was inscrutable during these meetings, he was frantically scribbling letters home to go in the diplomatic bag saying, "This isn't economic, this is political. They're going to actually do this, and we have a chance to shape it and make it in our interest if we join in properly." And Russell Bretherton said, "You know, I'm the wrong person. There should be a politician here. It should be a minister at least." And we've sort of reading what he wrote, you can sort of see this realization that the European community was so much more than just trading with each other, which, by the way, Tim, is a little lesson for our negotiators now. When they talk about German cars and French wine and Italian pasta, it's not just about economics and trade to our continental partners. A lot of it is about unity, and it is political. Anyway, Russell Bretherton was eventually sent home. Just before he was sent home, he was given something to read out. This gives you an idea of the mindset of the British at the time. And it said, gentlemen, what you are trying to negotiate, you will never negotiate. If you do negotiate it, it will not be ratified. If you do ratify it, it will not work. Au revoir and bonne chance.
So, and Bretton himself, he really was of the opinion that, you know, he clearly felt he shouldn't have been there, a politician should have been there, and it was an opportunity missed.
Yes, it was a real opportunity missed. Harold Macmillan knew that as well, and there's a record of him saying in the cabinet minutes around that time that we really should be there. But Rab Butler and Anthony Eden didn't really understand the vision, but also it's really important to understand two or three things. So the first thing is we'd won the Second World War. We thought we were invincible, and the price of victory is that we didn't have to do the thinking on economics, but particularly on politics, that the continental countries like France and Italy and Germany did. And the second issue was our relationship with the Commonwealth. We didn't want to let them down. And Eden and Butler just thought, well, in order to join this, we're going to have tariffs on Commonwealth goods. We import 50% of our goods, and we still do. And that's why one of the reasons why, by the way, we pay a lot into the budget. They couldn't see a way to sort of square these circles. And you have the special relationship with the USA, which is very big to Anthony Eden.
Sure. But I think you make the point in your book that John F. Kennedy actually suggests to Macmillan that we should have been more involved.
Yes. Now, Harold Macmillan became Prime Minister, and he began to suddenly see the effect of having to pay tariffs to export into Europe. And so he decided to apply to join. And the first thing he did was he went to the United States of America, and he told John F. Kennedy what he was about to do. And John F. Kennedy and his Secretary of State, George Ball, told him to get into the European community and try and change it from the inside, because if they try and change it from the outside, it would be almost impossible. And the reason why they knew that is because General Charles de Gaulle was the French president, and he was absolutely determined that if you join, you have to be European, you have to put Europe first. And also, let's not forget, France had actually joined at the beginning and were shaping it in their interest as well, and did so. And something that again, what politicians do now and other Brexit supporters do is they say, let's go back to a free trade relationship. We never had it, and we have never had it, because what happened was in 1956, when the European Community was formed, we tried to create a free trade relationship. It was called Plan G. Macmillan, as Chancellor, had asked for lots of plans on how to deal with the European Community, A to G. G was then used, and the idea was a free trade relationship, but in which the six members of the European Community would be traded with. And they quickly smelt a rat, because they realized that Britain could import stuff from the Commonwealth, which suddenly could be traded freely into them. And they said, you are not having the economic benefits without the political obligations, which I fear is what's going to happen now.
It's a sense of deja vu.
What happened was we negotiated for 2 years. Edward Heath, who eventually became Prime Minister, was our chief negotiator. And de Gaulle kept on saying, and he's often blamed for saying no, but all he said was, you can join when you're Europe first. Stop putting the Commonwealth first. Stop putting America first. And Macmillan said, no, I have all these obligations. De Gaulle reduced Macmillan to tears at Rambouillet in Paris at one of their meetings. And eventually, when Macmillan went to see John F. Kennedy, and de Gaulle had said to Macmillan, let's work on nuclear weapons together. And instead, Macmillan went to John F. Kennedy and got hold of some Polaris missiles from America, went back to de Gaulle and said, look, I've got some for you as well. And de Gaulle called a press conference a few days afterwards and said, Britain are not ready to join Europe. And he said the same thing in 1967. And what's important to him is what happened in between then and us joining the European community in 1973.
So let's take me through a couple of those. I know there are some more watershed moments. And so if you can just pick up on the main ones, because there's so much here and it is such a complex situation. We could probably be here for the next couple of weeks discussing it.
We could be, and I'd love
to.
But
timeline, and then people can dive into your book.
Yes.
For the full story.
There were some court cases in 1964 that established that every rule in the EU had to apply to every single country. There was another court case that established that the European Community was the primary legislature. De Gaulle arranged to have national veto in 1966, where people could veto something against their national interest. In 1969, the Common Agricultural Policy was created. France and Italy have over 20% of their GDP from agriculture, Britain 3%. The budget was created, where tariffs are collected and given to Brussels, and 1% of VAT is used. The Common Fisheries Policy was signed at 9 a.m. on the morning of our application in 1970, which meant we had to swallow it, something called the acquis communautaire. It's all the agreements we had, and we had to agree to all of it. In fact, Con O'Neill, who was in charge of our negotiation, he wrote a report, which wasn't released till 2000, that said that the negotiations to join the European Community in 1973 were accidental and secondary, because basically we were going to join whatever happened. We just had to accept everything.
Yeah. So our negotiating hand is not the strongest. And Margaret Thatcher had a role to play,
yeah,
in giving away some of our sovereignty.
She did give away, yes.
To me.
Well, it's an interesting one, and if I can just quickly go back to 75 and the referendum. The 1975 referendum was really unbalanced. There hadn't been a referendum to join the EU because it had been in Edward Heath's Conservative Manifesto. In 1975, you had 10 times as much money for the Yes campaign, all the newspapers supporting it apart from the Morning Star and the Spectator. But also within the Yes campaign's literature, it said, don't worry, there is some pooled sovereignty, but we've still got a national veto, so we can always protect our national interests. Well, when Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister, she won a rebate. Famously won a rebate, 66% of our VAT contributions, during which time she seemed to upset everybody. And so when she decided she wanted to create a proper single market, an end to non-tariff barriers, such as you can't operate an insurance thing in Germany, you can't sell a product like this in Spain, the way she wanted to do it, there were 289 of these barriers, is that she wanted to relax the national veto for 6 months and have majority voting, because she was advised that every country benefits from these non-tariff barriers, so they're all going to say it's in our national interest to veto it. So she was advised to ask for that, and she was sort of met by a bit of a pincer movement, in which Jacques Delors and Craxi of Italy and Mitterrand and Kohl said, actually, now we're growing and taking more countries on, Spain, Portugal and Greece, we should have majority voting on lots of things, health and safety and things like that. Otherwise, this veto just doesn't work for us. And in order to get her single market, she had to accept majority voting. And that really was the slide down to the point now where we have majority voting on a lot of things. And it does mean a lot more can get done. It just means a lot more might get done that we don't particularly like. Another thing in the Single European Act that was eventually created in 1987 was a line that said we commit to European monetary union. And Thatcher asked, well, what does that mean? Does that mean a single currency? And she was told, oh, don't worry, it's the same language they put in everything. But the next day, the Delors Committee was created, and they reported back with a three-stage process to what we now know as the euro. So Margaret Thatcher, despite being the sort of hero of Eurosceptics, gave away probably more sovereignty than almost anyone else, and then promptly formed opposition to her own policy.
Yeah, and I guess she never really admitted to any of this at the time, or later.
Well, some say, and historians will argue this, some say she was duped. She was reported by her Europe minister coming down the stairs at the Downing Street and saying, I've read this and I like every single word of it. I think she didn't understand the will to integrate and the political will to have a proper union that was exemplified by the picture of Kohl and Mitterrand holding hands. And when we ended up with the Maastricht Treaty, which was in 1992, which formalized the European currency, changed the European Community's name to the European Union, and created a EU citizenship, which added to freedom of movement by giving people all the same rights, whatever country they're in. Margaret Thatcher, who'd left government at the time, was calling people into her office, persuading them to vote against her successor's policy of ratifying the Maastricht Treaty, which is quite incredible. It's never happened since.
Mm. So just moving it on then to the referendum that happened last year. And it was built ahead of steam through immigration. You've got a great chapter titled Nigel Farage, the Pied Piper of Brexit. You know, which is, I suppose, the Pied Piper. What he did was he led an easily influenced tribe astray, didn't he? So is this the thing really? And how did it follow that route? And then I guess what made David Cameron ultimately, as you say, put a gun to there's a gun to his head, and why did he pull the trigger?
I mean, Nigel Farage's role in this is really important because in 1992, John Major talked about he wanted people still inside the tent. Nigel Farage was a Conservative Party supporter member at the time, and he left and he was outside the tent. And he decided to dedicate the rest of his life to getting us out of the European Union. And he talked a lot about sovereignty in the 90s. And then in the 2000s, an opportunity presented itself. And it presented itself because of a decision by Tony Blair not to have transition control on Eastern European immigrants. And let's not forget how important Eastern European accession was. A lot of countries, when their sort of controlling country dies, and this can happen in Iraq or Libya or Syria, you can get chaos. And when the USSR died, there could have been chaos, except we were there, or the European Union was there, to offer a democratic role model. And if you can create a democracy, there's all these prizes, you can join our market and things like that, which is amazing. And Blair was heavily involved in all of that. But going back to 2001, Blair had an election, and Germany also had an election. And Gerhard Schröder talked about immigration to the public and said, I know you're worried about this, and so I'm going to put in transition controls. Blair didn't mention it. So it gets to 2004. He doesn't put in transition controls on Eastern European immigrants. But what he says is that they'll join the worker registration scheme, and then we know where they are, so they can be schools and hospitals, and it'll all be fine. And one of the things that we found in our research was an email from John Denham, who was a Labour MP to Blair and Brown in 2006, and he's an MP for Southampton Itchen. And he said, since people have joined in 2004, construction workers in my constituency, their pay's fallen by 50%. And because most of these construction workers are self-employed who are coming, they're not on the registration scheme, so you don't know where they are. So they've never heard of a GP, so they go to the A&E for a cold. The schools are not coping either. There needs to be a migrant impact fund. You need to actually think about the effect this is having, because people forget that this particular wave of immigration, unlike previous ones, went to small market towns and other areas. But such was the way the Labour Party, New Labour in particular, worked at the time. They didn't really want to talk about immigration. People were called racists or a bigot by Gordon Brown if you talked about immigration. So people were looking for someone else to listen to them, and they found it in Nigel Farage. And at first it was BNP, you might remember, and then Nigel Farage, and then they had 1 million votes in 2010. And then under the coalition, because of a lack of, you know, suddenly you'd taken away the protest vote of Lib Dems, UKIP became the protest vote. And as he started to talk to Tory MPs and try and peel them off and things like that, put a lot of pressure on David Cameron. How am I going to win the next election, which mattered to Cameron? And we have a chapter about the crowbar referendum, as we call it, and why he called it. And it's very difficult to actually come to a reason, but people talk about the threat of UKIP. Some people talk about what he said himself. Democratic consent for the European community is wafer thin. Who knows? But the influence of Nigel Farage is huge, and I would actually say he's the most successful politician in terms of getting something done in the last 25 years. But when you actually fast forward to the referendum campaign, a really important thing that he admits is that because Boris and Michael Gove joined that campaign, it wasn't like in 1975 when it was all the extremist politicians. He had some mainstream politicians giving him political cover, and Farage went off to places where he knew he needed to get the vote out. 2.6 million people voted in 2016, hadn't voted in the 2015 election, and a lot of them voted Leave.
Yeah, you should be talking about David Cameron there. Mm. Did yourself, or probably Jason Farrell, who wrote the book with you, he's a Sky News political correspondent we mentioned at the top, did you go to Cameron and ask him specifically why he did call the referendum?
Well, he's not speaking...
Have you sent him a copy of the book as well?
Well, we will, but he's not. Unfortunately, because he's being very quiet and he doesn't normally contribute too much politically. We did obviously request for him to speak to us. We have a very good interview with Craig Oliver, who was his press officer and director of communications actually during this time, and worked with him very closely, and some other people that he knows. I think what Cameron will do is he will do probably what Tony Blair did around Iraq when he wrote his autobiography, and try and find a case that makes them, you know, hurts him the least politically, and try and explain it, because he's going to have to. But a lot of people are very angry at him, because the truth is that once he called this referendum, I think it was always going to be a leave vote. People talk about the 350 million bus, and they talk about the press and things like that. But actually, what had happened since 1973 is that no politician had ever properly sold the benefits of us being in the European Union to the British people. Every time, even when Tony Blair had gone and signed a treaty that helped to integrate Europe and was just in Europe's interest, he'd come back and talk about how he'd fought for Britain and got this opt-out or that opt-out. In 2011, David Cameron was the only person that didn't sign a sort of addendum to the Lisbon Treaty in order to deal with the Eurozone crisis, and he was talking about how he'd worked for Britain. And then 2 years later, 3 years, you know, he's leading a campaign to try and say, oh, actually, Europe is good, having been Eurosceptic his whole life. And that was very difficult, and he wasn't meant to lead the campaign either.
Mm. Now, I know when we talked ahead of the show, you were explaining, because you're a teacher and you teach teenagers, that one of the sparks, the inspiration for you to write the book was when one of your students asked you, how did you get to this position?
Yeah.
When you explain it to them, to them now, what kind of reaction do you get, and do you feel that you can sell Europe to them in a way that they think, actually, oh, I want to be European, or how do they respond?
Okay, yeah. So just to explain your story, on June 24th, 2016, I'm in West London, and it's Remain area. In fact, the two MPs nearest us have just been sacked from the shadow cabinet for voting on an amendment for single market, Ruth Cadbury and Andy Slaughter. So they were just asking, you know, how did this happen? Why? And they really want to understand it. And I wanted to learn to give them a better answer than I could give them at the time. And Jason and I ended up having a debate on the way down to Peppa Pig World with our daughters about this and agreed to write a book together. But in answer to your question, as I've learned about this, as I've done the research and found out all the things, remember, I'm a politics teacher, I write a daily blog, I didn't know a lot of this. I'm speaking at events at the moment around the book to politics teachers. They didn't know a lot of it. And now I essentially just try and explain to them, this is how people feel around the country. This book is not about the Westminster bubble. Jason was at a meeting in Newcastle, at the hustings about Europe during the referendum, and an MEP was talking about how immigration is good for GDP, and someone in the audience stood up and said, that's your GDP, it's not ours. The economy to people around the country is their local hospital, the local school, and their wages, not GDP. And what I've tried to do this year with my students is help them understand, and thanks to Jason going around the country and speaking to so many people, what it's like if you were a fisherman, what it's like if you were at the sea, if you work in or live in the seaside, what it's like if you happen to be in an industry where sometimes higher skilled people prepared to work for lower wages have come to the country. It's simple supply and demand, and they're not going to have as much idea about that. They live in London, where they really benefit from immigration, where they're used to it as well, it's been so long that we've been in the European Union, they've never really considered what it means that when you go to a general election, someone like me, I've never voted for someone who makes my laws, all my laws. They make some of them, but they don't make all of them. And one of the things that could happen, depending on how we leave the European Union, is that we will be able to vote for the person that makes our laws and rules and regulations. That's a way of looking at it. So a friend of mine who is a lawyer says, I'm fed. The reason he voted Leave is that I'm fed up of winning cases in the Supreme Court based upon laws I can vote for, and then having them overturn the European Court of Justice based upon laws I can't vote for. And if you're supposed to vote for the people who make your laws. And so I explain things like that, and at least I'm not trying to change people's mind. We're completely neutral on Brexit, Jason and I, in terms of good or bad. It's just about how do we explain to people who voted Remain that people who voted Leave are not mad, and how do we allow people who voted Leave to give something to people who voted Remain to explain, well, read this and understand us a bit more, because one of the things I don't like is the way it split the country.
Yes. Yeah. It's people have become more divisive, I guess, and people have become more to the extreme. Just in terms of the book itself and the flow of the book, obviously Jason, I think, takes it from the night of the referendum, and he's very much at the coalface of when that vote came down. And obviously, you're looking at the history side. So, how does it flow through? Do you take a chapter each, or is it sort of tie in with one another?
Well, we tried lots of different sort of architectures for the book. We were going to do chapter from history, chapter from the campaign, chapter from history. And as we wrote it, we started to realise that a lot of things that happened in the campaign, in fact, he takes it really from David Cameron's Bloomberg speech in January 2013, when he announced that he would be having an in-out referendum in the next manifesto. We felt that if you can read about all the history leading up to there, then what Jason's able to do as he tells the rest of the story is he's able to talk about everything I've talked about in history. Whereas if you try and do it as you go along, then he wouldn't be able to talk about certain things because I hadn't mentioned it yet. The campaign was definitely hugely affected by what had happened in history. When they say take back control, which was a slogan that Dominic Cummings came up with, and he was one of the organizers of the Vote Leave campaign, and he wrote a document which hasn't been published but we got hold of that predicted what would happen in the referendum. He wrote it in 2014. And ultimately, the thing that made a difference to focus groups is this idea of control. You have to understand where we lost that control and how we lost that control. When we're talking about immigration and its effect on the referendum, it's important to understand how that immigration happened and why it's so important to people. And so you've got I cover the history, and there's also a sort of extra chapter called The Rise of the Dispossessed, because along with the history of Britain and Europe, you've also got a group of people that sort of politics in this country forgot anyway. So they were looked after sort of in the post-war consensus, and then under Margaret Thatcher, coal mines, fishing, other things were sort of left to the free market. Blair came along, didn't necessarily change things for them. So it's a bit of a sort of political history chapter that fills in some gaps. And then Jason, when he talks about the campaign, he talks about the negotiation, he talks about Boris, he talks about the death of experts and fear fatigue, he talks about the madmen, as we call them, who ran both campaigns. It makes a lot more sense if you know the history behind it.
And just finally now, given you do know the history, can you make any predictions for us going forward about what's going to happen with the Brexit negotiations?
Yes. Well, first of all, my prediction is it's very difficult to predict. But what I will say is that we have to understand that it would be crazy for the European Union to give us a better deal than we have now. And the reason why is because they don't want other people to leave. We have to try and understand that negotiation has to involve a win-win situation. And how you can make it a win-win situation is not just about economics. This idea that they'll want us to buy their cars, well, they're going to lose one customer, we're going to lose 27. So my prediction is that a deal will probably happen, but that it's going to be very difficult to sell to the British public, I think, its immediate benefits. Maybe, and Daniel Hannan, who has written a book called Why Vote Leave and is a sort of intellectual godfather of the Leave campaign, he suggests we'll know in 2050 whether it's worked after a few years of having control. In truth, it's difficult. We've not had this before. If you look at even last week, the EU citizenship debate, this week, the EU don't want to allow people to live in this country without being under ECJ rules, because they say, well, they came to the country because you were in the EU, so they can't lose their rights. But if we do that, then we've got 3 million people in the country living under a different jurisdiction than we have. It's so much more complicated than people think. I hope that we maintain very good relationships with the EU, whether we leave or not. Nigel Farage said he thinks there might be a second referendum. I can see a route to that. Nobody knows what's going to happen. And I think it's going to be a little bit like someone was recently asked about whether they thought the French Revolution of 1789 was successful, and he said, well, it's too early to tell. I've got a horrible feeling that in 100 years we might be saying that too. But that's what makes it interesting, Tim.
Paul Goldsmith, thank you ever so much for joining us for today.
That's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That's all we've got time for today, folks. I hope you enjoyed the chat with Paul Goldsmith, and don't forget to have a look, have a search online and pick up a copy of the book. I think it'll be a fascinating read. You can get in touch with us through Facebook, Brexit Podcast, or Twitter at Brexit Podcast, or just drop us a note through the website and drop us some feedback on the shows. That would be terrific. The Brexit Podcast is a Tim Hemming, Jen Hahn, and Warren Pohl production. The theme music's by Kevin MacLeod, and we look forward to welcoming you back soon.